There's not been a crisis in my lifetime where the poor came out of the crisis better off.
And that was vintage Jim Murphy. He's one of the most decent and courageous Labour politicians I've ever spoken to. You can tell he's tough, but he's also compassionate. He's Catholic, and so am I. He's a loyal Scots, and he's Labour to the core. So a bit of background on him. He was Secretary of State for Scotland before leading the Scottish Labour Party in 2014. And before that, he'd served in cabinet in both Tony Blair's and Gordon Brown's governments. He was kind of a minister of everything, Minister for Europe, Technology, Employment and Welfare, and so on. So right now he runs Arden Strategies, giving progressive political parties campaign advice, setting up their campaigns for them, and also political analysis to corporates right across the globe. So I had a great talk to Jim about politics post-COVID, the sorts of values that we're bringing into the post-COVID world, and how political parties are coping. And we started by talking about how businesses are coping.
Jim, you give political advice to not just political parties, but companies and corporates in the UK and abroad. So, stock markets have recovered remarkably quickly post-COVID. Are they in denial, or are people actually putting their money where they see some real things happening?
I don't think the stock markets across the world are a fair reflection of the real economy. When you look at the likely consequence of what's about to hit the world in terms of the sort of lagged consequence of the remarkable shutdowns that we've all experienced, New Zealand, of course, different from the UK, but the UK is likely to be more affected than any other developed economy in the world, at a scale of two recessions simultaneously. That's the scale of the downturn the UK is about to go through, partly because the UK is so reliant on the service sector, it's so reliant on tourism. It's one in, I think it's about one, between one in three and one in four of the entire workforce who are currently furloughed on the government subsidised scheme. So this is going to get a lot worse, a lot worse before it gets much better, any better at all. Allied to all of that, the money that banks have been lending, and I'm making comments about the UK and Europe at the moment, I know less about New Zealand, but the money that banks have been out of necessity lending, partly at the encouragement of government who have underwritten much of the lending. Many of the terms around those loans coincide with the points where the many of the predictions are for this real spike in unemployment. So there's a real danger of a post-COVID, well, post first round of COVID economic storm of continued stagnation, real rises in unemployment, and then as the financial institutions, including the banks, try to claw back some of the money, then I think we're in for some really difficult times, all of which makes me worry about politics, makes me worry about society, because there's not been a crisis in my lifetime where the poor came out of the crisis better off. The poor have never prospered out of any crisis in the 50 years I've been on this planet. And less importantly, but also true, the sort of political centre left or left rarely succeeds in a meaningful way across the world in the immediate post-crisis period. And so for us, all of us who consider ourselves to be progressives and the candidates that we're helping in elections, of course, many of those elections are currently postponed. We've got to make sure they're not cancelled. But we've got to, when those elections take place again, and we've got to do our utmost to ensure that this isn't another generational setback for politics as it's been after the 2008 crisis and other previous crises.
So that's interesting, Jim. So class still matters in politics, doesn't it? For all the talk of it being less of an issue than it was, and what COVID does, you know, I know that John McTiernan has said it reveals, you know, it shines a light on what's already there, you know, or the Warren Buffett quote where, you know, when the tide goes out, you see who's swimming naked, and suddenly what COVID has revealed is that class still matters. So, you know, you look in America, 40% of black households have someone in the house who's lost their job. The predominantly frontline health workers who are putting their lives at risk are African American, and so on. And as you say, the poor never do well out of a crisis. But no one talks about class.
Yeah, well, politics. Politics is rightly more complicated than we believe the version of our politics in our history books. Politics is about a kaleidoscope of issues, but at its heart, a large part of it is class and income inequality and life chance inequality and life expectancy and inequality and everything else. And this crisis, certainly in Europe, New Zealand's experience is probably different, but in Europe, this will take years to recover for many of the poorest families, even to the position they were in on New Year's Eve of 2019-2020. And that's not getting them back to a prosperous position. That's taking them back to where they were just a few months ago. It'll take many, many years for that to happen. And look, I think that people who say class isn't important in politics are those who want to offer you the bread and circus of nationalism, who say that if what we've got in common is that we were born in the same country, on the same piece of land, and therefore that's what unites us. Well, at some levels that does unite us, and patriotism can be a great force for good. Nationalism rarely is, and certainly the because strongman protectionist nationalisms that you see in different parts of the world, they hope that they're able to persuade people who are materially much poorer as a consequence of the last few months, and indeed in many countries in the last few years, that it's more important to be free and poor than to have solidarity and be more prosperous. And certainly that was the playbook of Brexit. It was the playbook of Trump in a different way, because nationalisms have many common things, but they all claim to be different. That was in some ways the claim when we had the Scottish independence referendum back in 2014, which was, yes, we'll be poorer, but we'll be free. And we'll live under a Scottish flag, not a British flag. So that politics of identity is important, but ultimately a nationalist and nationalism has never fed the poor. It's never changed the life chances of someone who's born into poverty or disadvantage. And so there's a real contrast there between the politics of identity and the politics of class. And a smart politician managed to combine both of those.
Because I know in the UK election there was a lot of talk about how, you know, that Boris Johnson had broken the red wall, and there was an assumption that the poor and the working class had abandoned centre and left parties. But in fact, is it the other way around? You know, have parties of the left become alienated, if you like, from what we in New Zealand would call the smoke? That, you know, your working class communities and jobs in favour of the university common room?
Well, in the UK and in large parts of Europe, and certainly many of the countries that I and my team work in, social democratic parties are overwhelmingly run by, I'm not saying for, but by university educated, relatively comfortable elites for whom politics is a lifestyle choice. And we're in the political scrap of our lives. And to win, our politics has to be more than a lifestyle choice. And so we have no right to win. Progressive politics has no right to win. And right now, I hear many people saying the following, quote unquote, our politics has never been more needed or more relevant. Now, that's what everyone's saying. It's what liberals are saying. It's what the left is saying. It's what right-wing free marketeers are saying. It's what identitarian right-wingers are saying. They're saying it in private and many of them in public. Now, they can't all be right. They might all be wrong, but they can't all be right. And after the 2008-2010, whatever, financial crisis during those 2 years, certainly here in Europe, there was a sense of inevitability, a sort of conceit of inevitability, that history was on the side of progressives. Well, within a decade, we'd had Brexit, we'd had Trump, we nearly had the breakup of the United Kingdom, we've had Orban in Hungary, and we've seen populist movements. We've seen the re-emergence, the Front National in France, all after the 2008 financial crisis. So the idea that we just sit and wait for history to deliver progressive politics is bullshit.
Yeah,
it always has been. It always will be. And the problem, as I alluded to a moment ago, in progressive politics, it's lifestyle. I recycle, I'm a vegetarian, and I'm a social liberal who's in favour of progressive politics. Well, yeah. It has to be a lot more than just that. Incidentally, I recycle, I am a vegetarian, I'm trying to be a vegan. But politics is much tougher than any of that. And here in the UK, certainly the biggest dividing lines in our most recent general election just before Christmas were about education, with Labour overwhelmingly ahead amongst those who were university educated, and then geography, with Labour overwhelmingly ahead amongst those who lived in cities, ethnically diverse, university populated large cities. And the rest of the country, in the main, voted against the Labour Party. Well, surprise, surprise, there are more people in those parts of the country than there are in the parts of the country the Labour Party, as it went through its peculiar intellectual hard left spasm that had no respect for the patriotism or the lived experience of working class people. And it was an ultimate laboratory test of sort of extraordinarily patronising politics towards working class people. And I still voted Labour. It's the hardest it's ever been to vote Labour in my entire life. But the British public usually get elections right. And every election since 1945, because obviously here in the UK, like in other countries, history started in 1945. But in every election since 1945 that I've studied in the UK, the public get it just about right. When Labour loses, we deserve to lose. And when Labour wins, on balance, we deserve to win. And I'm not just saying that because someone who says, you can't sack the voters. Well, you can't. But the truth is, they usually get it about right. And unfortunately, the Labour Party did not deserve to win our most recent general election because we were aloof, elite, patronising, and completely out of touch.
It's that Deborah Matheson wonderful quote where she says, it used to be that when people thought of the Labour Party in the UK, it was a pie and a beer, and now it's a Chardonnay and a bowl of quinoa, wherever you pronounce it.
Absolutely. We've been a coalition throughout the Labour Party's history. We've been, from day one, we were a coalition of socialists, Methodists, Quakers, social democrats, trade unionists, non-conformists, teetotalers. We were a coalition of instincts and movements. And in the last couple of years, we have deliberately jettisoned so much of that. So the new leadership of the Labour Party, Keir Starmer, has got a hell of a job on. I think he can do it. But he's got a hell of a job on in a very short period of time to recover from a historic failure by the Labour Party.
Jim, if you look at, if you think of COVID, what we've just gone through, and thinking of some of these themes, you know, the left tends to default to being on the side of health, the right's on the side of the economy, the left's on the side of fairness and the state as the solution, right's on the side of responsibility, and they look to the market solution. And what gets out in all of that is actually community. And it's community that's actually got us through COVID. And if we look at New Zealand, where it's communities, families doing sensible things, keeping themselves separate, looking after their neighbours and so on. Is there a problem of the left, the slightly lazy temptation to go, oh, COVID is our moment. Look, government's back, big state's back, experts are back. We were right all along. We're going to be the Brahmin left and tell you how to live your life.
Yeah, so I'm going to adopt, I hope, a very firm rule that whenever I'm talking to politicians, if what they do is simply reheat their pre-COVID argument and say that the COVID crisis has proven that they were right all along, I'm not going to allow it to ever say that in any election that we are professionally supporting them, because it's churlish, arrogant, naive, and intellectually dishonest. Because this, one of the things I've been doing over a couple of things to reflect on. First of all, people's sense of what solidarity is, I think, is changing. So for the traditional left, solidarity would have meant a more active state, often a larger state, often a higher taxing state. And I think we've got to reflect on what version of solidarity people take out of what we've just been through. I haven't seen my parents since this started, so that's what, three or four months. But I've been to the front door of other people's parents' houses because I can deliver shopping for them through various charities. Now, my sense of solidarity is, and it's not transactional, but it's a sense of, I am helping in my spare time local charities deliver food and medicine and everything else to local families who are shielding. Alongside that, I know that other people are delivering food to my parents. And now, no one struck a deal or a bargain around that. It's just organically, an organic sense of solidarity. And so politicians that come after this and promise, and I think to people it'll sound more like a threat than a promise, people who promise that the man or woman from the government knows best, and the man or woman from the government is now going to instill a sense of solidarity, will be sneered at by a public who have found different ways of showing solidarity to complete strangers. It's not the state cannot be and must not be the only exemplar of solidarity that the left has. It is about, genuinely, and not in a simplistic sense, but we genuinely should find a politics of solidarity that respects individual freedom and that has the correct role for an agile state. Now, I think that on all of this, we've got to lead an argument. One of the failures of, as I said earlier, politics is a lifestyle choice for some in the sort of progressive politics. And we are literally liberal in our approach to thought leadership, in a sense that the public will inevitably get to our solution. We just got to sit and wait. And I think that so much of our politics over the next 5 years will dependent on what a 78-year-old guy from Pennsylvania can achieve in November. Because If Joe Biden manages to win, for all, and Joe, I like Joe a lot, a huge amount, huge respect for him. It's difficult for a man who almost be 80 by the day he's inaugurated to be the change candidate, but nevertheless, he has to be, because the billion-dollar fueled campaign of the Trump nativist rhetoric will inspire racists and populists all over the world.
Mm.
And therefore, the warning for all of us, who are, whether we're on the left, whether we're liberal, whether we're centrists, or whether we're even just one nation, decent conservatives, of whom there are very many, is that we all have to be prepared not to hunker down in the knowledge that this is coming at us, but we're ready to stand up against the pollution of every pore of our politics that Trump's nativism will cause. And I know for a fact, because I speak to enough politicians all over the world, many of their opponents, because we largely support liberal, progressive candidates in elections, these candidates all over the world are genuinely worried, and one or two are actually terrified of the consequence of Trump's megaphone, actually Facebook, not megaphone, Facebook-enabled nativist racism that will come from the Trump campaign, that will pollute European capitals and European politics and way beyond that.
So, Jim, what is the answer to Trump and populism on the right? What does the left do?
Well, the left can't look at Trump, Orban, and all of the other strongmen leaders across the world who, incidentally, are increasingly connected to one another through surrogates. We can't look at them and simply replicate their populism with our version of populism. We can't pretend that they are right. We can't offer any comfort to them. We've got to get up off our knees, stand up for our politics and our beliefs, and don't pretend that immigration is bad for our country, it's bad for our culture, it's bad for our economy, it's bad for our identity. We just got to share a truth, which is our countries are richer, more diverse, more successful, because of the real strength immigrants bring to our countries. For example, in the British NHS, over recent months, the system would have fallen over if it hadn't been for immigrants. Now, I think public attitudes in this country are changing towards immigrants. We have to try and, progressives, have to try and also make an argument, not just in favour of an individual immigrant who saved your grandmother's life, but in favour of immigration, as a fair version of immigration that's stronger for our country. So we can't surrender what we hold dear. Yes, we should reflect on what the COVID catastrophe and how it's changed our economy and our ways of life. Of course we have to. But that is not, the road to success is not a tepid version of our opponents or our opponents' style. It is being as ferocious as they are. It's as being as determined to win as they are. Much of this will be shaped on whether Joe Biden has managed to be successful in the presidential elections. Before that, of course, we'll look to see Jacinda winning in your September elections, and that will be another shot in the arm for progressives across the world, and that will be really important because increasing numbers of people across the world look to New Zealand as one of the bright spots in an otherwise gloomy political world. But the last thing I would say about how you respond to right-wing populists is that I've been involved in many elections, most of which I've won. I've been a candidate in a lot of elections and I've only lost one. And actually, there's only been one occasion where I was determined to win above all else. And it was when my name wasn't on the ballot paper and none of my clients' names were on the ballot paper in elections abroad. It was in the referendum to keep the United Kingdom together and keep Scotland in the UK as an expression of social solidarity and multiculturalism and much else besides.
So I just want to read you just a couple of sentences. It's from the Paul Collier book, where he talks about, he's trying to define the populists. And obviously he's thinking about the Trumps and the Obans and others. But just listen to this sentence. So he says, the charismatic populist eschews even the rudimentary analysis of an ideology, leaping directly to solutions that ring true for about 2 minutes. So hence their strategy is to distract voters from deeper thought through a kaleidoscope of entertainment. And the leaders with these skills are often drawn from a very tiny pool, media celebrities.
The answer to right-wing populism cannot be a sort of knee-jerk left populism that says, all business is bad, stop the world, I want to get off. Immigration is bad. Immigration and immigrants are bad for our country. Multiculturalism, multi-faith, a sort of rich tapestry of sort of what many of us celebrate, that those things are bad. The progressive voices should never be complicit in the lie that, in general, immigration is good for our country. It's good for our cultures. It's good for our economies. By the way, even further, if it hadn't been for immigrants in the British National Health Service, it's unimaginable where our country would have been. Incidentally, I think possibly one of the tiny upsides of the COVID thing catastrophe here is that public attitudes to immigrants may change. What's not yet clear is whether public attitudes to immigration will change. There may be a grudging acceptance amongst those who previously were unwilling to offer it, that actually my grandmother's life was saved by an immigrant. One of the things we've got to do, I think, is then make an argument for immigration rather than just for the individual. So the response to right-wing populism can't just be an unthinking alternative of sort of centre-left populism. And therefore, you've got to tell the public your truth.
And that was Jim Murphy, former leader of the Labour Party in Scotland, serving minister in Tony Blair and Gordon Brown's governments, now head of Arden Strategies, and he's a goddamn hero. I don't think I've heard anyone say it with such clarity. The poor never come out of a crisis like COVID better off, and people don't automatically flock to progressive governments after a crisis. I mean, just look at the GFC. We've got Trump, we've got Viktor Orban in Hungary, the rise of Putin, the list goes on. So believing that this moment will deliver popular support for progressive policies is lazy. And that's a challenge to the educated classes running Labour parties right across the world. Yes, this is a crisis, not necessarily for you, but for the people who may never have been to university, who are likely to lose their jobs, if not today, then in the next few months or next year. This is going to get worse before it gets better. Jim was clear about that. When the banks and the institutions start asking for their COVID loans to be repaid, more businesses are going to go under, more jobs are going to be lost, and that will inevitably impact on our politics. And again, history tells us that the call to be free but poor wins every time over the promise of solidarity and prosperity. And that's how we ended up with Brexit and Trump. I know from my own experience, it's how my brother and my sister-in-law and my family voted for Brexit. This call to be free but poor wins every time. And part of the reason for that is that people identify the word solidarity with the left's promise of big state. So now solidarity has to be about more than that. It has to capture the neighbours who took food to people on their street, the people who took food to Jim Murphy's parents. That's solidarity. And politics has to be more than just about identity, not because identity isn't important, but because the politics of identity never change the life chances of someone born into a poor household. Politics can't be about recycling, even though, again, that's important. But politics isn't a lifestyle choice. It's a mission. And right now, we're in the fight of our lives. If progressive people don't get this right after COVID, the populists, the nativists on the right and even on the left will win. And history will be proven right again, that the poor never come out of a crisis better off. And the job of progressives is to change that history. I'm Josie Pagani. Thanks for listening. The next podcast on politics post-COVID will be up shortly.